Chapter 5 American Graffiti 1971 through 1973. The weeks following the implosion of Zoetrope had been tough on Lucas. He was feeling abandoned by Coppola, who by early 1971 was already deep in pre-production work on The Godfather, part of his ongoing effort to earn enough to pay Warner back its $300,000. But while Coppola had a job, Lucas didn't. For now, he and Marcia were getting by, albeit just barely, on what Marcia was making editing Michael Ritchie's film The Candidate. In the meantime, Lucas was considering taking side jobs as a documentary cameraman, or raising the money needed to make more of the small, arty tone poems he loved. There was also Apocalypse Now, still in free fall since its abandonment by Warner on Black Thursday. It was the only project Lucas had that was actually in script phase, and he still had big plans for it even as he and Milius continued passing the pages back and forth. Lucas had recently brought in another collaborator for the project as well, a serious, soft-spoken 30-year-old producer named Gary Kurtz. Like Lucas and Milius, the Los Angeles-born Kurtz was a graduate of USC Film School, though he liked to point out that when he graduated in 1963, the film school was a poor cousin to the one Lucas and Milius attended a year later. Like most film school graduates, Kurtz couldn't find a job in Hollywood, so he simply stayed at USC as an employee, working on medical information films for the U.S. Public Health Service and running the school's film library. Eventually, he also found a job working for Roger Corman, where he became a jack-of-all-trades, managing sound, cinematography, even special effects. Unlike Lucas and Milius, however, Kurtz didn't escape the war. In 1966, Kurtz was drafted by the Marines and sent to Vietnam. He was halfway through his basic training, he remembered, when, basically, I realized that I was a conscientious objector. A sympathetic and savvy superior advised Kurtz to keep his objections to himself and put a film camera in his hand instead of a rifle. Kurtz spent 2 years in Vietnam in a film unit, squinting through the eyepiece of a camera at blood and burning villages, an empty holster on his hip. He returned home in 1968 with a newfound spirituality, carrying himself with the quiet dignity of a Quaker, even growing a chin-curtain beard that gave him a slight resemblance to Abe Lincoln or Captain Ahab. Kurtz made his way back into film, and by 1970, he was working with director Monty Hellman, another Corman disciple, on the road movie Two-Lane Blacktop. The film was decidedly low rent, hurriedly financed by Ned Tannen at Universal to surf the Easy Rider wave, and Kurtz, trying to stretch his budget as far as he could, wanted Hellman to shoot Two-Lane Blacktop in the inexpensive 35mm Technoscope format. The only problem was that neither Kurtz nor Hellman had ever worked in Technoscope before, so Kurtz called on Coppola, yet another member of the Corman fraternity, for a bit of help. Coppola, with his typical bombast, told Kurtz that he needed to visit one of his protégés who had just finished shooting his first film, THX 1138, in Technoscope, and was editing the movie in his attic in Mill Valley. As instructed by Coppola, Kurtz drove out to Mill Valley and knocked on the door. When Lucas answered, Kurtz thought he looked like a film student. "He was just this little guy," said Kurtz, in jeans and tennis shoes and an untucked dress shirt that seemed two sizes too big for him. But the more he and Lucas talked, and the more he watched Lucas deftly work the controls of the Steenbeck editing table, the more Kurtz liked him. "We both came up in the school of doing everything ourselves," said Kurtz. "He was my kind of filmmaker." Kurtz left impressed and went off to make Two-Lane Blacktop in Technoscope, while Lucas continued to wrestle with Warner over THX for the rest of 1970. But it was the beginning of one of Lucas's most important creative partnerships. Lucas and Kurtz would oversee 3 gigantically successful films together in the span of 10 years, and it was perhaps only fitting that Coppola had been the one to connect Lucas with his next big brother figure. I knew George Lucas by reputation. I'd seen some of his student films, remembered Kurtz. But it was Francis who brought us together. It was Coppola, in fact, who now brought them together again as Lucas was mulling over Apocalypse Now. Coppola had seen some of the footage Kurtz had shot in Vietnam and suggested to Lucas that Kurtz might be the ideal collaborator on a war movie. Kurtz, however, wasn't so sure. Unlike the polar opposites Lucas and Coppola, Lucas and Kurtz were cut from the same temperamental cloth. Both were quiet and low-key, and Kurtz worried that neither of them had a forceful enough personality to run a movie set. But he and Lucas got on well enough that they decided to move ahead anyway. Kurtz was genuinely intrigued by Apocalypse. He saw it as their opportunity to make a dark comedy in the same vein as Robert Altman's 1970 film, MASH. But the more they talked, the more Lucas waffled. There was some question as to whether it was really their film to shop around anyway. Technically, it was the property of Zoetrope, though the typically defiant Lucas continued to argue that the film actually belonged to him and Milius, and that Coppola had had no right to use it as a bargaining chip in the first place. More than anything else, however, Lucas was having second thoughts about making a war movie at all. With a highly unpopular war still splattered across the front pages of the newspapers each day, Lucas shuddered at the idea of taking part in some insidious, cynical trend. I was working on basically negative movies, Apocalypse Now and THX, both very angry, Lucas said later. I realized after THX that people don't care how the country's being ruined. All that movie did was to make people more pessimistic, more depressed, and less willing to get involved in trying to make the world better. He decided, we've got to regenerate optimism. After THX, Lucas was driven to make a movie that was not only optimistic, but also mainstream, marketable, and exciting. Apocalypse Now was shelved, but Lucas definitely wanted to keep working with Kurtz. So while vowing they would come back to Apocalypse Now at some point in the future, he and Kurtz continued to kick around ideas for a new film. What kinds of movies did they like? What did they think was exciting? For a moment, they considered a remake of the Kurosawa classic, The Hidden Fortress, reimagining it in a more modern setting in the same way director John Sturges had transferred another Kurosawa film, The Seven Samurai, from ancient Japan to the Old West in his 1960 picture, The Magnificent Seven. What really got them both fired up, however, was Flash Gordon. Lucas animatedly described watching the Flash Gordon serials he had loved watching on KRON as a kid. But he didn't need to bother. Kurtz was a fan, too, and excitedly discussed with Lucas the possibilities of acquiring the rights from King Features. Lucas reached out to the syndicate, even making a quick trip to New York to plead his case. But they were way too expensive for us, recalled Kurtz. King Features had perhaps intentionally priced Lucas out of that market, holding out hopes for a big-name director to take on their franchise, since they were also coyly dangling the rights in front of Federico Fellini. Lucas kept the pressure on, and they weren't averse to discussing it, said Kurtz, but their restrictions were so draconian that we realized right away that it wasn't really a great prospect at the time. The syndicate ended up overplaying its hand, as Fellini, too, would pass. Both Lucas and Kurtz knew that what they really wanted to do was some kind of Flash Gordon-like science fiction story, said Kurtz. It was something that we wanted to see, that we would pay to go see, and no one was making it. If Lucas couldn't get the rights to Flash, then he'd simply create a world of his own that didn't have to adhere to someone else's rules or work with someone else's characters. By denying Lucas Flash, King Features had inadvertently sent him down the path toward creating Star Wars. Flash Gordon, in fact, wouldn't appear on the big screen until 1980, in a Dino De Laurentiis-produced stinker trying hard to cash in on the science fiction craze Lucas had spawned with Star Wars, an irony that was never lost on Lucas. But Lucas wasn't ready to start on another science fiction movie just yet. After THX, I was considered a cold, weird director, a science fiction sort of guy who carried a calculator, and I'm not like that at all, Lucas said later. In addition to Marcia, Coppola too had challenged Lucas to try something different. "Don't be so weird," Coppola told him. "Try to do something that's human. Don't do these abstract things," he advised Lucas. "Why don't you try to write something out of your own life that has warmth and humor?" Challenge accepted. "If they want warm human comedy," said Lucas, "I'll give them one, just to show that I can do it." He thought he knew exactly how to go about it. Lucas would later claim it was his growing interest in anthropology that was the impetus behind American Graffiti. "I became fascinated with the modern mating rituals of American youth who did their dance in cars rather than in the town square or in other ways that societies have done these things," he would tell reporters 40 years later. And yet, that was probably only partly true. Mostly, the writer who hated to write was following the path of least resistance, by writing, as Coppola had suggested, something out of his own life. "If you're a writer and a director," said Lucas, "you make movies about the things you know about." For Lucas, then, that meant there was never any doubt what he would write about. "Growing up in Modesto, I spent many years cruising 10th Street, and I was enamored with the experience." That still didn't mean the actual writing process was going to be any easier. "As I started out with American Graffiti, I said to myself, I don't want to write this. I can't stand writing," Lucas confessed later. "And I frantically went around trying to get a deal to develop the script." Getting a deal, however, would require at least an outline. So Lucas wrote a 5-page treatment about 4 young men, most of them cruisers or cruiser wannabes, getting ready to leave high school, with their lives veering off in very different directions. Lucas envisioned a coming-of-age film in the same vein as Fellini's I Vitelloni, which follows 5 young men as they go through pivotal points in their lives. "It was kind of the same issue about growing up," said Lucas. "It was one of the themes in my first film, THX, and I wanted to expand on it." With some help from film school pals Willard Hike and his wife Gloria Katz, Lucas's 5-page proposal was eventually fleshed out to 18 pages. Lucas promised the Hikes that if the proposal sold, they'd get the screenwriting job, then handed the proposal off to another new partner in his creative life, a 22-year-old agent named Jeff Berg, for Berg to shop to the studios. For Lucas, looking to studios to back a project was like tucking his tail between his legs. He'd vowed never to be a part of the Hollywood machine again. But with no money and no prospects, Lucas was going to take whatever he could get. Unfortunately, his timing couldn't have been worse. In March 1971, just as Berg was taking American Graffiti around for review, THX 1138 had landed in theaters, and despite an appealing proposal for his second film, Lucas was damaged goods. "The easiest job you'll ever get is to try to make your first film," Lucas ruefully noted later. "That's the easy one to get, because nobody knows whether you can make a film or not. After you've done that feature, then you have a heck of a difficult time getting your second film off the ground. They look at your first film and they say, 'Oh, well, we don't want you anymore.'" And they didn't. Nearly every door was closed in Berg's face. Only David Chasman, a producer at United Artists, who'd overseen the James Bond films and A Hard Day's Night, took a passing interest. THX 1138 did have its fans, and most of them were in France, where THX had been selected as one of 52 films to be shown as part of the director's fortnight at the Cannes Film Festival. So it was in this roundabout way that Lucas's first film helped him get his second one made. "Of course, Warners wouldn't pay for us to get there," grumbled Lucas. But Lucas decided to go to Europe anyway. "What the hell," he told Marcia. "Let's go." He and Marcia took their last $2,000 out of the bank to pay for an extended trip. They planned to live as cheaply as they could, staying in hostels or with friends, and backpacking most of the way. Their largest expense would be a set of Eurorail passes. Walter Murch and his wife, Aggie, gamely agreed to join them. The Lucases left California in early May, headed for London, where they planned to stay for a few days in a cheap pension before heading to Cannes. Their first stop, an extended layover in New York City, where George and Marcia would spend the night with the Coppolas. Lucas was determined to make the most of his brief time in New York by paying a visit to the offices of David Picker, president of United Artists, the one film studio that had expressed even remote interest in American Graffiti. If I could just get to him, Lucas figured, maybe I could pitch this and they can make it happen. Lucas did get to him, and he pitched American Graffiti hard, reminding the mogul of David Chasman's interest in the project as well. Picker nodded, took a copy of Lucas's American Graffiti proposal, and said he wanted to think about it. Picker, too, was heading for Cannes later in the week and asked Lucas to check back in with him once he arrived in London. Lucas spent a restless night with the Coppolas. Francis was in severe trauma, he said, deeply embedded in work on The Godfather and hating nearly every moment of it. It was just non-stop anxiety, said Coppola, and wondering when I was going to get fired. Adding to the tension, Ellie Coppola was 9 months pregnant with their daughter, Sophia. We had to leave at around 7 a.m. to catch the plane to London, recalled Lucas. But Francis and Ellie got up at 4 in the morning, running through the room on the way to the hospital, because she was in labor. She had Sophia that day. When we got to London, I found a payphone and called David Picker, who said, I've thought about this, and you can have some money, and you can write American Graffiti. I'm going to be at the Carlton Hotel in Cannes. Come visit me there, and we'll talk about it. It was May 14th, Lucas's 27th birthday. So, it was my birthday, it was Sophia's birthday, and I got American Graffiti all on the same day. Picker didn't have a lot of money to offer, only $10,000 to develop the full screenplay. But it was enough for Lucas to call the Hikes in California to let them know he had a deal. I got the money, he told them. We can start working on the screenplay. To his disappointment, the Hikes declined. They were preparing to make their own low-budget horror film in London and couldn't commit to writing a full screenplay. Lucas hung up and called Gary Kurtz. I want to get this thing off the ground, he told Kurtz, and the two of them agreed to give the assignment to Richard Walters, another USC classmate. But Lucas wanted Walters to work fast. Ideally, the screenplay should be complete when Lucas returned home from Cannes. Kurtz told Lucas he would take care of it. Satisfied, the Lucases headed for Cannes, already several days into its 25th anniversary celebration. Charlie Chaplin was there. John Lennon and Yoko Ono strolled the boardwalk, as did most of the Rolling Stones, who were there to catch the premiere of the rock documentary Gimme Shelter. Lucas was in awe, but with no money, he couldn't even get tickets to the showing of his own movie. He and Marcia had to sneak in a back door. To his delight, French audiences loved THX, and Cannes officials put together a press conference where Lucas could talk about the movie. An event Lucas didn't even know about, and thus failed to attend, much to the annoyance of his hosts. I was barely able to get into my own picture, let alone get to a press conference, Lucas explained. But for a number of years, the French thought I was a real snob. Lucas did keep his appointment with Picker, however, showing up at the Carlton Hotel as directed, and meeting the studio president in one of those big suites, he remembered. That was my first big-time movie experience. Here they sealed the deal on American Graffiti, and did Lucas have anything else? In a moment reminiscent of Coppola enthusiastically giving away the unfinished Apocalypse Now in his pitch to Warners, Lucas told Picker all about his ideas for his unnamed space opera fantasy film in the vein of Flash Gordon. Great, said Picker. We'll make a deal for that too. And that, said Lucas later, was really the birth of Star Wars. It was only a notion up to then. At that point, it became an obligation. As Lucas left the meeting, Picker handed him his own tickets for Cannes events so the young couple could enjoy the rest of the festival in style. When it ended, on May 27th, the Lucases spent the next several weeks riding trains across Europe, and in a reminder that you could take Lucas off the drag strip, but you could never quite take the drag strip out of Lucas, they caught as many car races as they could before getting back to the States and their movies, including the Le Mans Endurance Race and the Monaco Grand Prix, before getting back to the States and their movies. When Lucas returned to California in late summer, he called on Richard Walters to check on his progress with the script for American Graffiti. Right away, he knew he had several problems. First, Kurtz had promised Walters the entire $10,000 Picker had provided for script development, meaning Lucas was already out of money before he'd even read a page of the script. The other problem was the script itself. As Lucas sat reading it, he really looked grim, recalled Walters. George always looked as if he was ready to be executed, and I can tell he doesn't like this draft. According to Walters, Kurtz had given him the 18-page proposal, described the basic plot, and then told Walters to pay no attention to these pages. Walters, thinking he had been given free rein, offered to base the screenplay on a rock and roll novel of his own set in New York, called Barry and the Persuasions, hardly the California cruising scene Lucas had outlined. I'm a Jew from New York, Walters said later. What do I know from Modesto? We didn't have cars. Kurtz had wisely nixed that idea, but Lucas still hated the final script that Walters turned in. I ended up back home with a completely worthless screenplay about drag racing that was basically hot rods to hell, said Lucas. It was completely different than the original treatment. My intense desire to get a writer had backfired on me, and I ended up with an unusable script and no money. Excruciating as the experience might be, then, Lucas would write it himself. So over the next 3 weeks, Lucas wrote from 8 in the morning until 8 in the evening, 7 days a week, bleeding on the page, as he would always put it. In late summer, agent Jeff Berg took the completed script back to David Picker at United Artists, and Picker rejected it outright. While he was still intrigued by the idea, he was disappointed with Lucas's execution. 4 different yet interwoven storylines, carried along by a rock and roll soundtrack, while common and nearly a cliché today, back in 1971, no one had ever seen or heard of such an approach to filmmaking. The kind of structure I had presented just wasn't done in those days, said Lucas. With a failed science fiction film to his name and a new script no one wanted, Lucas had no real prospects and no money. Desperate, he borrowed money from Coppola and, the ultimate humiliation, from his father. Financially, he was struggling, recalled his sister Kate. It was a difficult time for him. I think being my father's son, he didn't believe in debt. But Lucas was also determined not to take no for an answer. Berg was to keep shopping the script until he found someone, anyone, who could appreciate what Lucas was trying to do. In the meantime, he picked up a bit of work from Coppola shooting a montage for The Godfather in early 1972. The sequence of spinning newspaper headlines and crime scene photos as the five families go to war. But not much else. Still, Lucas was determined to keep pressing ahead, working with his attorney to file the necessary paperwork to officially incorporate Lucasfilm Limited. At the moment, little more than a shell corporation with a placeholder name. As he and Kurtz filled out the forms, Lucas nearly balked at the continued use of the very British extension, Limited, instead of its Americanized counterpart, Incorporated. He was a bit leery of it, said Kurtz. He thought it was kind of an ego thing. But we thought we'd just call it that for the incorporation and worry about it later. They would never worry about it again. It would remain Lucasfilm Limited in perpetuity. As Berg shopped around the American Graffiti script, he found that, while there were few takers for the film, there were studios interested in Lucas as a director. Tomorrow Entertainment, in particular, wanted Lucas to direct a feature the studio had in the pipeline, a heist film starring Donald Sutherland called Lady Ice. The studio made Lucas an attractive offer, upping his directing fee to $100,000, as well as a piece of the net profits. There were other offers, too, to direct movies based on The Who's concept album Tommy or the rock musical Hair. I had all these producers calling me saying, I hear you're really good at material that doesn't have a story. I've got a record album I want you to make into a movie, Lucas recalled. And they were offering me a lot of money, but they were terrible projects. Still, he did need the money. Lucas talked it over with Marcia, who encouraged him to remain steadfast in his pursuit of American Graffiti. After all, if graffiti sold, he couldn't be in the middle of a project for someone else. Lucas then turned every offer down, but it wasn't easy. "That was a very dark period for me," he said later. "We were in dire financial straits. I turned that down, Lady Ice, at my bleakest point. When I was in debt to my parents, in debt to Francis Coppola, in debt to my agent, I was so far in debt I thought I'd never get out. It took years to get from my first film to my second film, banging on doors, trying to get people to give me a chance," remembered Lucas. "Writing, struggling with no money in the bank, getting little jobs, eking out a living, trying to stay alive, and pushing a script that nobody wanted." Two hurdles were making Graffiti a tough sell for Berg. One was the title, which studios found baffling. It sounded, they thought, like an Italian movie about American feet. The larger problem, however, was that Lucas was pushing American Graffiti not just as a movie, but as some sort of musical, actually writing across the first page of the script, "American Graffiti is a musical. It has singing and dancing, but it is not a musical in the traditional sense because the characters in the film neither sing nor dance." It was no wonder studio executives were confused. Making things worse, Graffiti was seen as yet another movie trying to cater to the youth market, a movement Dennis Hopper had crashed just as spectacularly as he had created it when his Easy Rider follow-up, The Last Movie, tanked at the box office. And then, in early 1972, the script landed on the desk of Ned Tannen at Universal. Tannen, an early fan of Lucas's THX student film, was also a car lover, though he was a southern rather than northern California cruiser. And so he thought he knew what Lucas was trying to do in his script. Tannen and Kurtz had a relationship as well, having worked together on Two-Lane Blacktop several years earlier. Tannen thought this was a team he could probably work with. He called Berg and told him he wanted to meet with Lucas to discuss American Graffiti. Lucas showed up in Tannen's office with a cassette filled with music recorded from his own exhaustive collection of 45s. Buddy Holly, The Beach Boys, Elvis, The Platters. Everything he had listened to cruising Modesto as a teenager. Just as the front page of his script promised, Lucas pitched American Graffiti as a musical, and as he described to Tannen the stories of each of his four main characters, Lucas played a corresponding song from his cassette. Each song, he knew, would evoke a particular moment in time. What a certain generation of Americans thought being a teenager was really about, from about 1945 to 1962, he said later. And it worked. Tannen immediately got it. "It's about every kid you ever went to school with," enthused Tannen. "It's about everything that ever happened or didn't happen to you, or that you fantasize or remember as having happened to you." Yes, he and Lucas could do business, but there were some conditions. First, Tannen generally produced only films budgeted at $1 million or less. Graffiti would be budgeted at $750,000, and Lucas would have no studio space at his disposal. The film would have to be made on location. More critically, there would be no additional budget set aside to cover the costs of clearing the music rights. If Lucas wanted to use Elvis songs in American Graffiti, that was fine, but he'd have to pay for it out of his $750,000. That was less money than Lucas had received for THX 1138, and he knew it might take as much as $100,000 to cover the music. Before he could shoot a single frame of film, Lucas knew at least 10% of his budget would be gone. Making things even more challenging, there was one final and perhaps more difficult demand. The studio wanted a well-known actor involved, someone whose name on a movie poster would capture the attention of an audience. Lucas argued that since the movie was about teenagers, the cast would likely be made up mostly of young, unknown actors, and he had no intention of compromising the story to arbitrarily insert a marquee grade star. Tannen conceded Lucas's point and suggested finding a big-name producer instead. And in the spring of 1972, following the release of The Godfather to outstanding reviews and box office numbers, that stunned even its director. There was no bigger name than Francis Ford Coppola. Tannen and Coppola had tangled in the past. Tannen would always call Coppola Francis the Mad, but the idea of promoting American Graffiti with Coppola's name attached to it dazzled Universal executives. Lucas was still nursing a grudge against Coppola over the demise of Zoetrope, and, if put on the spot, would likely have admitted he was hoping to be regarded as an independent filmmaker and the head of Lucasfilm Limited, rather than as Coppola's young apprentice yet again. But knowing Coppola as well as he did, he knew Francis would stay out of his way, leaving the day-to-day on-location producing to Kurtz. Lucas told Tannen he'd be more than happy to have Coppola as his producer, and then went to discuss it with him. "Yeah, sure, great," Coppola told Lucas, then threw out what he thought was an even better idea. "You know, we should be doing this picture," said Coppola. "Let's get it out of Universal. I'll finance it myself." Lucas, on the verge of a deal with Universal, thought that was a bad idea. If Tannen found out Coppola was trying to take the movie away from him, it might scuttle the deal altogether. But it was Francis being Francis again. Lucas decided to give Coppola a bit of time to see what he could do, and with his profits from The Godfather as collateral, Coppola went to the Citibank in Beverly Hills to secure a loan for $700,000 that he could put toward American Graffiti. But both his accountant and his wife put an immediate stop to Coppola's plan before it could even get underway. Ellie Coppola didn't like the script and informed her husband in no uncertain terms that if he was going to gamble his profits on a film, it would be one of his own and not one by a protege. Chastened, Coppola decided not to pursue the loan. He'd take Universal's money instead. "We didn't get the okay from Tannen with the script," Kurtz recalled later. "We got it with Francis's name. They, Universal, thought the concept might work, but they wanted to be a little more certain, and his reputation provided the certainty." With Coppola officially on board, Tannen could ink the deal. As producer, Coppola would earn $25,000 plus 10% of the net. Lucas, meanwhile, would be paid $50,000 to write and direct, as well as 40% of the net profits. While the figures were small, the deal was generous and one that promised to make both Lucas and Coppola quite a bit of money if, and this was a big if, American Graffiti could turn a profit. Finally, as he had in his initial agreement with United Artists, Lucas also rolled his untitled space opera, The Flash Gordon Thing, into the deal with Universal. If all went well, it would be his next project. Lucas was generally happy with the arrangement, and it was Tannen, in fact, who'd gone to bat for Lucas with studio head Lou Wasserman, who was skeptical of American Graffiti and even more suspicious of the Flash Gordon thing. Tannen later said he simply had a hunch about Lucas. "You could just feel something big was going to happen to him," said Tannen. Lucas liked Tannen too, and particularly appreciated the way he worked. "Universal, in effect, wrote you a check and told you to go away and come back with a finished movie," Lucas said later. "They never bothered you at all. It was a very, very good atmosphere." Well, mostly. There was really only one thing Lucas didn't get in the deal: control over the final edited version of the film. After the relative failure of THX, there wasn't much room for Berg to negotiate the point on his behalf. Lucas grudgingly agreed to give Universal editorial control, and once again, he would end up regretting it. With Universal behind him and Kurtz watching his back, Lucas put American Graffiti into pre-production immediately. He set up a production office in San Rafael, about 15 minutes away from Mill Valley. Lucas liked the look of San Rafael's main streets. Unlike in Modesto, storefronts still looked much as they had a decade earlier, and he planned to shoot most of the movie's exteriors there. Searching for cars from the appropriate era to cruise the streets during filming, Lucas put ads in Bay Area newspapers promising owners $20 a day to drive 1962-era cars in the background. Kurtz's assistant, Bunny Alsop, who was also his sister-in-law, photographed every car and driver who responded to the ads, so Lucas would have a variety of cars to choose from. It was Kurtz, however, who found the 1932 Deuce coupe with the chopped top that would be cleaned up and painted yellow, yet another yellow sports car, to create American graffiti's most iconic automobile. Perhaps the most pressing business at the moment was getting the rights to the music. Without the music, insisted Lucas, there was no film. It was, he reminded everyone, a musical. Lucas had made up an extensive song list, selecting at least three songs for each scene in the event he couldn't clear one or two of them. When Kurtz ran the list by executives at Universal, they practically had a heart attack, said Kurtz, and urged Lucas to record the songs with an orchestra or a cover band instead. Kurtz blanched. We can't do that, he said. We have to use the original records. Executives eventually agreed, but warned Kurtz that if clearances exceeded 10% of the budget, the difference was coming out of Coppola's pocket. Lucas wasn't going to be able to afford about half of the songs he wanted anyway. Right away, Elvis's music was out, the rights were too expensive, and the King's label refused to negotiate. Kurtz had better luck with the Beach Boys, mainly because he knew drummer Brian Wilson personally, after working with him on Two-Lane Blacktop. Kurtz eventually secured a number of Beach Boy songs, including Surfin' Safari and All Summer Long, for a reasonable fee. And once Kurtz and Lucas could point to the involvement of the Beach Boys, clearing song rights became much easier. Eventually, Lucas would clear 43 songs for the movie, including hits by Buddy Holly, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, the Del Vikings, and Booker T. and the MGs. Lucas had just secured the soundtrack that would make the film, and he and Kurtz had brought the clearances in for around $90,000, right on target. Casting, too, was critical. Lucas still intended to use young actors close in age to the characters they were playing, even scouring local high school drama productions looking for promising talent. On the recommendation of both Coppola and Kurtz, Lucas turned to veteran casting director Fred Ruse to help him through the process. For Lucas, the casting wasn't just important, it was personal. Each of the four main characters was rooted in his own personality and life experiences. I'm sort of everybody, Lucas said later. They were all composite characters based on my life and on the lives of friends of mine, he told a reporter. I was Terry the Toad, fumbling with girls. Then I became a drag racer like John. And finally I became Kurt. I got serious and went to college. Really, the only character he had struggled with in his script was the overachieving Steve. That was the only character I really wasn't, he said. Nevertheless, I have a lot of friends who were the Steves, who stayed and just sort of followed the path that was laid out for them. For weeks, Lucas held open auditions so he could sift through as many actors as possible. With Ruse next to him, Lucas saw thousands of young performers in 10-minute increments, 6 days a week, 12 to 14 hours a day. Lucas took notes on everybody, scratching his thoughts down in notebooks, in his crabbed handwriting, and rarely saying much of anything. His silence distressed some of the young actors. He hardly said two words to me, said Candy Clark, who would end up with the role of the ditzy but well-intentioned Debbie. He was mostly looking at me, which makes for a very uncomfortable audition when someone is just sizing you up, not interacting. Once the first round of auditions was complete, Lucas picked four or five actors for each of the major roles, paired them up into boy-girl couples, then videotaped them so he could watch their performances closely over and over again, a practice that would become an industry standard. After poring over the videos, Lucas would then take the best two or three from each couple and record their performances again, this time on 16mm film. It was a long, excruciating process, but Lucas was determined to make exactly the right choice for each role. The weeks of hard work paid off, as Lucas was able to assemble a note-perfect cast, the majority of whom would go on to long careers. Lucas had been impressed enough with Richard Dreyfuss to offer him his choice of playing either the intellectual but adventurous Kurt or the popular but conflicted Steve. Dreyfuss chose Kurt, believing he was much more like that character. Suzanne Somers, in her first real film role, was given the part of the enigmatic Thunderbird-driving blonde bombshell who nearly persuades Kurt not to leave his small town. To escape, as Lucas explained it, the same theme that had driven THX 1138. Kurt's all-night quest for the blonde in the hot car has more than a whiff of Lucas's own truth to it, according to his mother. George always wanted to have a blonde girlfriend, but he never did quite find her. Kurt wouldn't either. The character who did land the blonde, however, was probably the one the most like Lucas. Terry the Toad, played with geeky enthusiasm by Charles Martin Smith. "There's so much of George in Terry the Toad, it's unbelievable," said John Plummer. "The botching of events in terms of his life, his social ineptness in dealing with women." Smith had missed the first rounds of graffiti auditions, but Lucas ran into him in a studio office building and asked him to try out. And it probably didn't hurt that with his thick-rimmed glasses, Smith even looked a little like Lucas. Cindy Williams, who landed the role of Lori, the ingenue role, Lucas called it, was jet-lagged and bleary-eyed throughout the audition process and thought she'd be so bad in the role that she very nearly didn't accept it until pressed by Coppola. "I was just awestruck that Francis Coppola would call me," Williams said. "I was like hypnotized. 'Yes, evil master, I will do the film,' I said. 'Of course I will.'" The role of Steve, the character Lucas had struggled with the most on the page, went to one of the more experienced and youngest actors in the film, 18-year-old Ron Howard. While Howard had more than a decade of acting experience, including an 8-year run on the highly successful Andy Griffith Show and a memorable role in the film The Music Man, it was still uncertain whether he could carry a film as an adult, mainly because it wasn't clear whether audiences would accept that Andy Griffith's precocious Opie had grown up. In 1972, in fact, Howard was preparing to enter film school at USC, determined to become more than just an actor. But when he heard that Lucas was holding open auditions, Howard decided to read for the part. He did so with some trepidation, he said later, mainly because he too had been confused by Lucas's insistence on calling graffiti a musical. "George, I have to admit one thing," Howard told Lucas during his audition. "I know I was in The Music Man, but I think they cast me because I couldn't sing, because I really can't. And I certainly can't dance. In fact, I can just barely carry a tune." Lucas shrugged. "Oh, don't worry about it," he told Howard. "You wouldn't have to sing. No one really sings, but it is a musical." "And that was it," said Howard, who landed the part and never asked about singing again. But he would remain baffled, at least for a while, by Lucas's musical. It was casting director Ruse who would bring in one of the more unconventional cast members, a self-taught carpenter named Harrison Ford. Struggling as an actor, Ford had taken up carpentry to pay the bills, and was so good that he had earned a reputation as the carpenter to the stars, building a recording studio for Sergio Mendez and a deck for Sally Kellerman, and doing odd jobs for the art rock group The Doors. Ford was doing so well, in fact, that he very nearly didn't take the role playing hot rodder Bob Falfa, since it paid less than half of what he was making doing carpentry jobs. While Ford eventually settled for a little more than scale, he drew the line at having his hair buzzed into a flat top. Lucas agreed to permit Ford to tuck his hair up into a white cowboy hat instead. It would not be the last iconic hat Ford would wear for Lucas. It had taken 5 exhausting months to cast the film. Working with actors was never Lucas's strong suit anyway, but he had set himself a particularly grueling schedule, flying from San Francisco to Los Angeles each week to sit through auditions all day, then crashing on the couch at Matthew Robinson's house in Benedict Canyon at night. Fortuitously, Lucas wasn't the only one in Robinson's house. That spring, Robbins was at work on a script for Steven Spielberg called The Sugarland Express, and Spielberg would drop by every evening to talk about the script over dinner. "So they'd still be around the kitchen table discussing their script," said Lucas, "and we'd have dinner, talk, and hang out. That's where we really got to know each other." From the moment of their first meeting at the student film exhibition at UCLA in 1969, when Spielberg joked he'd been insanely jealous of Lucas as a filmmaker, Lucas and Spielberg's relationship would always be a mixture of good-natured competition and warm admiration. In January 1971, for instance, after Spielberg had flashily directed an episode of the NBC series The Name of the Game, titled L.A. 2017, Lucas had taken wry delight in pointing out that its setup, a vaguely dystopian future in which residents of Los Angeles live underground, bore more than a passing resemblance to THX 1138. But Lucas had nothing but praise for Spielberg's most recent effort, an edge-of-the-seat made-for-TV thriller called Duel, about a mild-mannered motorist being stalked by the unseen driver of a tanker truck. Lucas had watched it at Coppola's house during a party, shutting himself into an upstairs room while the festivities raged below him. "I ran downstairs and said, 'Francis, you've got to come see this movie. This guy's really good.' I was very, very impressed with his work." Spielberg, too, would always look back fondly on those long evenings in Benedict Canyon, swapping stories with Lucas and grousing about the challenges of getting a film made. "We were the movie brats who got together a long time ago and decided to talk about how hard it is to make movies," said Spielberg. "I mean, we're constant complainers. We love complaining to each other." The dinner table conversation at Robinson's Place, complaints and all, would cement their blossoming friendship for good.